Chapter 8. Dude with a Problem. Surviving the Ultimate Test. Warning: this chapter contains spoilers for the following books. The Martian by Andy Weir. The Firm by John Grisham. The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas. The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. Misery by Stephen King. As much as we love our stories about the chosen one and those destined to save the world, sometimes as readers, all we want to do is be inspired by an ordinary guy or gal who rises up to extraordinary challenges. Enter the dude with a problem. In other words, an ordinary guy or girl encounters extraordinary circumstances. It's hard to find a more relatable genre because we are all ordinary dudes or dudettes. And we all know that any ordinary day can become extraordinary in the blink of an eye. Unlike in superhero stories, these dudes are not special and not destined to save the world, at least not when the story begins. They're just average Joe Schmoes or Jane Schmaines, going about their daily lives, minding their own business when, bam! Through no fault of their own, they find themselves dragged into a hot mess of trouble that they certainly did not expect nor invite. And are they equipped to handle this world of hurt they suddenly find themselves in? Seemingly not. But that's what makes the dude with a problem stories so dang good. Eventually, our dudes and dudettes will rise to the occasion and accomplish things that they and we never thought possible. Dudes come in all shapes, sizes, genders, races, and occupations. From Mark Watney in The Martian by Andy Weir, a regular dude astronaut, to Stanley Yelnats in Holes by Lewis Sacker, a regular dude kid, to Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins, a regular dudette teen living in Panem, to Mitch McDeer in The Firm by John Grisham, a regular dude lawyer. Even Buck in Call of the Wild by Jack London is a regular dude dog. All of the stories that fit into the dude with a problem genre are stories of a lone man, lone woman, or lone group, or lone dog, who find themselves facing incredible odds, and whose survival often includes a struggle to hang on to their own sanity. Our dudes usually don't ask for this trouble. Sometimes they're not even sure how they got involved, but involved they are. They've got big problems on their hands. In fact, the bigger the problem, the better the story. But remember, problems are relative. You gotta match your problem with the right dude or dudette. Taking into account your dude's given background, characteristics, and skill set. It's the relative size of the challenge that makes the stories work. Mark Watney, for example, is a skilled astronaut and botanist. He would have no problem surviving in, let's say, the jungle. But that's not where Mark Watney finds himself, is it? He finds himself stranded and alone on freaking Mars. For most of us non-astronauts, what Mark accomplishes in The Martian would be literally impossible. But for Mark, it's only nearly impossible. And that makes all the difference. Because literally impossible makes for a very short and boring story, usually ending in death. But nearly impossible? That makes for some great fiction. Another thing to note is that novels of this genre tend to work better if there are external bad guys in the mix. These are the forces working behind the scenes, throwing new and exciting challenges at our poor protagonist at every turn. Whether your bad guy is an individual, like Annie Wilkes in Misery by Stephen King, an organization, group, or government, like the firm of Bendini, Lambert, and Locke in The Firm, or the capital in The Hunger Games, or a force of nature, like Mars in The Martian, or The Sea in Life of Pi by Jan Martel. The golden rule of villains remains the same. The badder the bad guy, the greater the heroics, the better the story. So make them bad. Better yet, make them progressively badder as the story goes on. Think about Katniss Everdeen in The Hunger Games, facing harder and harder challenges from the capital game makers as the competition goes on. Or even Mars itself, throwing more and more obstacles at poor Mark Watney the closer he gets to escaping the planet. Regardless of who the bad guy or bad force is, the satisfaction of reading a Dude with a Problem novel comes when our dude uses his individuality to outsmart the enemy in the end. This is where that perfect pairing of dude and problem comes into play. Mitch McDeer may not be able to survive on Mars, but he can survive a corrupt law firm because he's a clever and ambitious lawyer. It's important to give your dude the abilities they'll need to conquer their problem up front, abilities baked right into their character DNA. But it's equally important that your dude and your reader not fully realize their potential and how they can use these skills until the time is right and the ultimate challenge is upon them. The combinations of dudes and problems are endless, but the rules of the genre remain the same. You gotta have 1, an innocent hero, 2, a sudden event, and 3, a life or death battle. First off, the innocent hero. They should have been dragged into the problem without asking for it. Wasn't Mark Watney just going about his day-to-day chores as the botanist aboard Hermes 3 before a sudden freak Mars storm left him stranded on an uninhabitable planet? And wasn't Katniss Everdeen just going about her day-to-day life, hunting with Gale, trying to make ends meet for her family, when wham, Prim's name gets called at the reaping? It's the hero's innocence that makes us readers love these stories so much. That dude could be us. We could find ourselves in the same situation and have to defy the same impossible odds. These are stories of survival, not punishment for a crime we committed. Hence, the innocent hero. Unlike Monster in the House stories, which we'll talk about in Chapter 13, what the hero did to get into this mess is not what the dilemma is about. It's about how they're going to get themselves out of it. Second, we need a sudden event that thrusts the hero into their world of hurt. Sudden being the operative word here. These catalysts come seemingly from nowhere and force the hero to come to grips with what's happening, ASAP. Star Williams in The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas is completely unsuspecting when her friend Khalil is shot by a police officer. Katniss Everdeen doesn't have time to think about her decision to volunteer for the Hunger Games in her sister's place. She just does it. And Mark Watney doesn't have time to hem and haw about his situation of being stuck on Mars. He's got to act fast. And finally, we need a problem worthy of this epic story. There must be a life or death battle involved in which the continued existence of an individual, group, or society is at stake. If Mark Watney doesn't get off Mars, he dies. If Mitch McDeer doesn't find a way out of this firm, he dies. And if Katniss Everdeen doesn't kill 23 other tributes, she dies. Star Williams in The Hate U Give also faces a life or death battle, but it's the battle for the continued existence of the community she grew up in. Khalil's death and the aftermath are tearing her neighborhood apart. In other words, the problem must be big. If you want to know whether your problem is big enough, try pitching your story to someone else. Their reaction should be something along the lines of, "Dude, that's a huge problem." And hopefully, their next thought is, "What would I do in that situation?" If you've succeeded in this test, then congratulations. you've got yourself a killer dude with a problem story. Another element you'll often see in dude with a problem stories is a love interest. They're not always there, but when they are, these characters are typically used as champions or cheerleaders for the hero. Isn't Peeta Mellark in The Hunger Games Katniss's biggest supporter and confidant? Isn't Chris in The Hate U Give on Star's side through thick and thin? These B-story characters are the ones who will help the hero ultimately believe in themselves and find the strength they need to conquer this problem. These characters also often offer solace to our struggling dude or dudette in times of need. Tender scenes between the hero and the love interest can often be found in what's called the eye of the storm moment. This is the part of the novel where the action slows down for a minute, and the hero and reader get a chance to relax and reflect, and basically just breathe. When we have all action all the time, it can start to lose its potency and weary the reader. Think about the scene in the cave in The Hunger Games when Peeta and Katniss kiss, or the prom scene in The Hate U Give. So much is going on in Star's life at that moment, yet author Angie Thomas slows it down and gives us a welcome reprieve from all the drama with just a nice, normal high school prom. Danger is still lurking. The storm still surrounds the hero. But in these moments, it's effective to take a break from the insanity and just be. These are also great opportunities to amp up love stories and friendships. In the end, all Dude with a Problem novels are about the triumph of the human spirit. Our dude has survived. Or if he hasn't, there's a good, compelling reason for it. A reason that really makes us think. Dude with a Problem stories remind us that we, average humans, are actually a lot less average than we thought. We have hidden strengths, hidden talents. And when put to the test, we persevere, we overcome, we triumph. Reading these stories makes us feel alive and inspired. One lone teen defying an entire government? One lone astronaut defying an entire planet? One lone lawyer defying a firm run by the mob? There's nothing more inspiring than that. To recap, if you're thinking of writing a Dude with a Problem novel, make sure your story includes these three essential ingredients. An innocent hero, who is dragged into the mess without asking for it, or possibly even aware of how they got involved, but in some way has the skills to overcome the problem, even if those skills are buried at first. A sudden event that thrusts the innocent into the problem. It should be definite and come without warning. A life or death battle that threatens the continued existence of an individual, group, or society. Popular Dude with a Problem novels through time include Robinson Crusoe by Daniel Defoe, Holes by Lewis Sacker, The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins, The Martian by Andy Weir. For a complete list, please reference the bonus PDF that came with this audiobook. Here is the beat sheet for Misery by Stephen King. Save the cat genre, dude with a problem. Book genre, psychological thriller. Total pages, 351. Scribner paperback, 1987. This book wouldn't be complete without a breakdown of a Stephen King novel. King is one of the most famous fiction writers of our time. His novels have sold more than 350 million copies around the world. Although many classic Stephen King novels fit into another Save the Cat genre, Monster in the House, I chose to analyze this psychological thriller, a shining example of a dude with a problem, because, well, it's about an author struggling to write the best novel of his career. the opportunity was just too apropos to pass up. But also because, according to King, he wrote this novel about a fictional author feeling chained to his popular series of romance novels as a metaphor for his own frustration at feeling chained to the popular horror novels that launched his career. Not to mention, it's just one heck of a well-structured story. Writing a novel can sometimes feel like you're trapped inside a house with a crazy psychopath who is threatening to kill you if you don't finish. But on a less dismal and more inspiring note, in Misery, King depicts writing as a much-needed escape from our own miseries, and sometimes the very thing that can save our lives. 1. Opening image, pages 1 through 6. Our hero, Paul Sheldon, wakes up in a fog of pain. He's barely conscious, close to death. Someone is breathing into his mouth, trying to resuscitate him. When he comes to, he learns he's in Sidewinder, Colorado, with a woman named Annie Wilkes, who, according to her, is his number one fan. 2. Setup, pages 7 through 36. As Paul slips in and out of consciousness, we learn more about him. Paul is the famous author of the Misery books, a series of Victorian-era romance novels. In the latest and last of the series, just released, Paul has killed off his main character, Misery, mostly because he hated writing the books and wanted to try his hand at a new genre. Paul had just finished his latest manuscript, Fast Cars, of which he's extremely proud. We also learn what happened to Paul to land him in this situation. His car crashed, and Annie, who used to be a nurse, found him, pulled him out, and splinted his broken legs. Annie has been giving Paul a painkiller called Novril, and he's now addicted to it. Paul soon surmises that Annie is crazy, dangerous, and unpredictable. She withholds drugs from him when he's in pain. She claims that they are a ways from town, and that's why she can't bring him to the hospital. The road conditions are too bad. But despite the fact that Annie saved him from that car wreck, Paul slowly starts to realize that Annie is keeping him prisoner here. After Annie reads Paul's latest manuscript, she flies into a rage. Not only is it not a Misery novel, she's a huge fan, it's also full of swear words, which she highly disapproves of. As a punishment for his dirty mouth, she makes Paul take his pills with soapy water. 3. Theme stated, page 19. As Paul tries to piece together what happened to him and why he's here, Annie tells him, "You owe me your life, Paul. I hope you'll remember that. I hope you'll keep that in mind." Page 19. There are many fascinating themes in this novel, but the theme stated as it applies to Paul's life lesson is about survival and its ironic connection to his ghastly predicament. Despite the horror that befalls him in the next 332 pages, Annie did in fact save his life when she pulled him from the car wreckage. But more than that, Annie, through horrifying means, will ultimately push Paul to write his best novel to date, Misery's Return, the book that will end up saving his life both literally and figuratively. On page 7, King writes, "He was Paul Sheldon, who wrote novels of two kinds, good ones and bestsellers." This was Paul's view of himself at the start of the novel. He turned his nose up at the Misery novels, the ones that made him successful. But by the end, Paul will learn that bestsellers can be good if he puts in the effort to make them good. When Paul finally finds the inspiration for Misery's Return, he finds his escape from the misery of his situation, and he finds his will to live. So, in a disturbing yet brilliant Stephen King-esque way, Annie Wilkes does save his life, in more ways than one. 4. Catalyst, pages 36 to 40. Annie Wilkes is unstable. We're already starting to realize this. But it's not until page 36 that Paul, and we, the reader, see just how bad it can get. When Annie finishes Misery's Child to discover that Paul killed off the main character, putting an end to her favorite series, she goes ballistic, overturning the table by the bed. She then storms out of the room and tells Paul that she's leaving before she does something unwise. Paul is left alone and crippled in the house, without food, water, pills, or any indication of when or if Annie is coming back. This is the incident that finally pushes Paul to try to do something about his situation. 5. Debate, pages 40 through 70. But what will he do? That is the debate question. After a day passes, he starts to wonder if Annie is dead. If she is, he will definitely die in this room. But Annie does return, and Paul immediately begs for his medicine. He's in a lot of pain. She agrees to give it to him if he agrees to burn his Fast Car's manuscript. She wheels in a charcoal grill. Paul is torn. He has no other copies. This is it. If he burns it, it's gone. But he needs his pills. He burns it, and then secretly vows to kill her. Later, Annie brings him an old typewriter, the Royal, and tells him she wants him to write a new Misery novel, Misery's Return. It will be just for her, her payment for nursing him back to health. Will he do it? He asks Annie if she'll let him go when he's done with the book. She vaguely says yes. Paul knows she's lying, but also knows that writing the book she wants might be the only thing that will keep him alive. 6. Break into 2, page 70. Paul's answer to the debate question is a proactive decision. He agrees to write Misery's Return. But he's also surprised to find that he's sort of looking forward to writing again. 7. B Story, page 109. The B Story is Paul's relationship with the Misery's Return book. You might even say that Misery Chastain, the main character of the series, is the B Story character, as she is the one who will ultimately teach Paul the theme. Before coming to Annie's house, Paul had already happily dismissed this character, this world, and this series. He was done with Misery Chastain. But the longer he writes the novel, and the more Annie pushes him to make it fair, meaning not to phone it in, the more Paul finds himself drawn into the story, getting inspired by the plot and the character, and ultimately making it one of the best novels he's ever written. The irony was that the woman had coerced him into writing what was easily the best of the Misery novels. Page 209. Misery's Return saves Paul's life, both literally and figuratively. There are many instances when the ending of the novel is the one bargaining piece Paul has against the crazy, unstable Annie Wilkes. And at the same time, the unfinished book gives him a will to live. Something we novelists can definitely relate to. 8. Fun and Games, pages 70 through 170. The second act centers on the writing of Misery's Return. This is the Act Two world for Paul. He hasn't gone anywhere new, there aren't any new characters introduced, but he's still going to an unexpected place. Back into the series he thought he was done with. The novel within a novel format of King's book allows us to see some of Paul's efforts as he chugs away on the manuscript. But the writing gets off to a rough start. When Annie buys him the wrong kind of paper for the typewriter, she gets angry and punches him in his shattered knee before storming out of the house again. Unsure of how long she'll be gone this time, Paul picks the lock on the door and wheels his wheelchair out of his room in an attempt to call for help. But the phone has been disconnected. He finds the stash of Novril painkillers in the bathroom and stocks up, just managing to get back into his room and hide the pills under his mattress before Annie returns. Paul works on the first few chapters of the book, in which he has to figure out a way to bring Misery back to life, since he killed her at the end of the last novel. Annie doesn't approve of the first draft, saying that he cheated and the resurrection of Misery wasn't fair. Paul realizes he can't just phone in this book in order to get it over with. Annie is too smart for that. He'll have to actually put some effort into this project. Theme. On page 127, he has an idea, something that really inspires him. He begins to write, quickly losing himself in the writing. On page 130, King writes, Paul had no idea she was there, had no idea, in fact, that he was. He had finally escaped. Annie reads the first six chapters of the novel and loves them. Shall I go on? Paul asks on page 148, to which Annie responds, I'll kill you if you don't. It's dark and twisted, but another nod to the theme that Annie Wilkes will ironically save his life by pushing him to write his best novel yet. For the next few weeks, Paul gets lost in his writing, averaging 12 pages a day. Paul and Annie establish a routine. He writes during the day, then after dinner, they watch TV together. Strangely enough, despite his horrific situation, the fun and games takes on the feel of an upward path as Paul gets sucked deeper and deeper into the writing of his novel, losing himself in the story. 9. Midpoint, pages 170 to 180. The book is going well. Paul is actually enjoying the writing. On page 170, King writes, but it was also more richly plotted than any Misery novel since the first, and the characters were more lively. This is turning out to be one of the best books he's written. But obviously, this is a false victory, because, well, he's still held captive in a psychopath's house. To remind us of this, the stakes are raised a few pages later when the rain comes and Annie falls into a deep depression. Paul always knew she was crazy and unstable, but this shift seems to reveal a whole new side of Annie. He realized he was seeing her with all her masks put aside. This was the real Annie, the inside Annie. Page 175. And after Annie suggests that they both kill themselves, Paul realizes, I'm closer to death than I've ever been in my life. Page 177. Annie finally says what neither of them had yet uttered aloud, that she's never going to let him leave, that she will eventually kill him. Paul buys himself time, though, by saying he doesn't want to die until he's finished the novel. Time clocks appear. She agrees, but says she has to leave for a while, and Misery Chastain saves Paul's life yet again. 10. Bad guys close in, pages 181 to 266. Once Annie leaves, Paul ventures out of his room again, searching for a means of escape. All the doors are bolted shut, and even if he could get out, he realizes he's miles away from anything. How would he get anywhere in his condition? Paul battles with his own sanity, internal bad guys, as a voice inside of him tells him to give up on ever getting out of here alive, a rejection of the theme. But Paul vows not to give up. He stocks up on food from the kitchen, and then on his way back to his room, catches sight of a scrapbook titled Memory Lane. This is when the external bad guys really start to close in. In flipping through the scrapbook, Paul realizes that Annie is even more dangerous and crazy than he thought. In fact, she's a serial killer who's killed countless people, family members, children, even babies. And somehow she keeps getting away with it. In her last trial in Denver, there wasn't enough evidence to convict, and Annie walked again. Paul realizes that if he's to have any hope of getting out of here alive, he'll have to kill Annie Wilkes. He starts to think of how he could do this, finally settling on stabbing her in the throat. He finds a knife in the kitchen and hides it under his mattress. Annie returns and injects Paul with something. He loses consciousness, and when he awakes, Annie reveals that she knows about every time Paul has picked the lock and gotten out. She even knows that he's been looking through her scrapbook, and she's taken the knife that he hid under the mattress, destroying Paul's hope of fighting back. Then Annie explains that the stuff she injected him with was a pre-op shot, page 227, Paul freaks out, wondering what she means by pre-op. Then Annie hobbles Paul by cutting off one of his feet and cauterizing the wound with a blowtorch to ensure that he doesn't try to escape again. As Paul deteriorates, also losing a thumb to Annie, so does the typewriter he's been writing on. It was already missing the N key, and it soon loses the R key and the E key, making it harder and harder for him to finish the book and stay alive. He finally chooses to handwrite instead. This is not only another sign of his downward path, but a nod to the metaphor of writing a book in general. The further you get, the harder it becomes. As Annie's mental state gets worse and Paul's sanity continues to falter, he realizes that he owes his life to Misery Chastain, the B-story character. He was no longer sure, not about anything, with one exception. His whole life had hinged and continued to hinge on Misery. He should have died, but couldn't, not until he knew how it all came out. Page 246. In fact, both Paul and Annie are hanging on, staying alive to find out how the book ends. 11. All is Lost, pages 266 to 273. A police car pulls onto Annie's property. At first, Paul is paralyzed, unable to scream for fear of Annie's retribution. Then he finally calls out for help and throws an ashtray through the window of his room, shattering the glass and getting the cop's attention. But the moment the cop recognizes Paul as the missing writer, Annie kills the cop, whiff of death, stabbing him repeatedly and then running him over with the lawnmower. Afterward, she turns to Paul and says, "I'll deal with you later." Page 273. 12. Dark Night of the Soul, pages 274 to 295. Paul begs Annie to kill him and get it over with. All hope of surviving and finishing the novel is gone. Annie carries Paul down to the cellar, and Paul thinks she's going to amputate another body part. But instead, she locks him in while she goes to dispose of the cop's body. Before Annie leaves, she restates the theme. "All I ever did was pull you out of your wrecked car before you could freeze to death, and splint your poor broken legs, and give you medicine to ease your pain, and take care of you, and talk you out of a bad book you'd written and into the best one you ever wrote. And if that's crazy, take me to the loony bin." Page 282. It is crazy, and yet it's so true. Paul knows that there is no escape. He will die after he finishes this book. He's sure of it. All hope of survival is lost. There's a literal dark night of the soul as Annie leaves and locks Paul in the dark cellar with the rats. 13. Break into Three, pages 295 to 300. But as Paul waits for Annie's return, dozing in and out of consciousness, he spots Annie's charcoal grill, the one she used to make him burn fast cars. As an idea starts to form, hope returns. Paul finally sees a way out of this. He steals the can of lighter fluid from the grill before Annie comes back. 14. Finale, pages 300 to 348. Point 1. Gathering the team. In preparation for his big finale plan, Paul vows he'll finish the book in a week, but makes Annie promise not to read any more until he's done. Then Paul hides the can of lighter fluid under the baseboard in his room. Point 2. Executing the plan. Paul writes, furiously trying to finish the novel. When another cop comes, Paul doesn't scream or alert him. He wants to be the one to finish Annie off, and he really does want to finish the book for himself. Theme. Paul finishes the manuscript and asks Annie for a single cigarette, telling her he always has one after finishing a book. She agrees and brings him a single match. While she's in the other room, Paul pulls the lighter fluid out from under the floorboard. He douses the manuscript, and when Annie returns, excited to read the ending, he sets the book on fire. And it's good, Annie. You were right. the best of the misery books, and maybe the best thing I ever wrote. Too bad you'll never read it. Page 327. As Annie reaches for the burning manuscript, Paul smashes the typewriter on her back and then stuffs burning pages into her mouth, choking her. She's able to get up, but trips over the typewriter and hits her head on the mantel, falling down dead. Point 3. High Tower Surprise. Except she's not dead. Annie opens her eyes and crawls toward Paul. She reaches him and strangles him, but passes out before she can kill him. Thinking she's dead again, Paul crawls out of the bedroom and shuts the door. Her fingers poke under the door, grabbing for him, before she finally lies still. Point 4. Dig deep down. Paul pulls himself to the bathroom, finds the novel, and downs 3. As he sleeps, he struggles with his sanity again, still unable to believe that she's dead. He keeps thinking he hears something, but is it just his imagination? He's terrified, but he knows he has to go back into that room. He has to get the real manuscript. The one he burned turns out to be a fake. He has to save the book that saved him. Paul opens the door to the bedroom and thinks he sees Annie alive, but it turns out to be just his imagination. The cops show up, and Paul musters the strength to cry out to them. Point 5. Executing the new plan. The cops find Paul, and he tells them what happened and points them toward the bedroom. When they get there, there's no one inside. 9 months later, Paul is mostly healed, with a prosthetic foot replacing the one Annie chopped off. Misery's Return is about to come out, and the publisher has scheduled a print run of 1 million copies, an unprecedented number. The novel is on track to be a massive success. Despite all of that, Paul still sees Annie in the shadows, and he still misses his Annie dope. It seems he was addicted to her almost as much as to the novel. We learn that Annie had crawled to the barn and died there from the blow to her head she sustained after tripping on the typewriter. The very typewriter that had saved Paul's life killed her. But in Paul's mind, she will never really be dead. He will continue to see her in his nightmares and when he writes. Like it or not, Annie Wilkes will forever be his miserable muse. 15. Final Image, pages 349 to 351. After seeing Annie coming at him with a chainsaw, Paul gets inspired to start writing a new idea. He feels terror as he writes, but also disturbing gratitude. Why is this a dude with a problem? Misery contains all three elements of a successful dude with a problem story. An innocent hero. Apart from killing off his main character, a crime only in the eyes of psychopath fan Annie, Paul Sheldon did nothing to deserve the horror that befell him when Annie Wilkes brought him into her house and held him captive. A sudden event. The car crash that left Paul crippled and incapacitated is the sudden, unexpected event that thrusts him into this story. A life or death battle. Paul must fight and write for his life, aware that at any moment, Annie might crack and kill them both. If you'd like to read an abbreviated version of this beat sheet, check out the Cat's Eye View for Misery, which can be found in the bonus PDF.